The Brendan O'Connor Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Advice and expertise on the relief you need from hay fever at All Care Community Pharmacies across Ireland.
Now, our panel today, Cleen O'Farrelly is a professor in comparative immunology in Trinity College Dublin. Ingrid Miley is, recently departed industry recently and employment correspondent from RTE, and all views today, now your own, I suppose, for the first time ever. So Ingrid, ready to let loose, we hope. And Paul Hosford, political correspondent with The Examiner. Guys, you're all very welcome. Now, what we'll do first, though, is let's go to Copenhagen. And, of course, what really was, I think, among football fans and everybody else, widespread shock yesterday when Christian Eriksen collapsed on the pitch during a Euro match between Denmark and Finland. Gary Lineker tweeted that in 25 years of doing this job, it was the most difficult, distressing and emotional broadcast he'd ever been involved with. And I think we saw a lot of hard-bitten sports journalists all over the news and channels and radio yesterday, and all clearly very shaken by it. Journalist Philip O'Connor, you were at the match yesterday. Good morning.
Good morning, Brendan.
Can you tell us how it all unfolded from the point of view of a spectator in the stands?
Yeah, it was the strangest day I've ever seen in sport, Brendan. The whole day we thought, you know, this is it. The pandemic is over. It's party time. Finland were at the finals of a major tournament for the first time. The Danes, who won the tournament in 1992, were playing on home soil for the first time. And parking is kind of beside a big green open space. So there's just people playing football and drinking beer and enjoying the summer the whole day. And then we got into the stadium and the game started really, really well. The Finns were defending. The Danes were attacking them. It looked like a goal was going to come any second. But then all of a sudden, just as we got up towards half time there, the Danes were taking a fairly innocuous throw in just up on the left wing, and as Christian went to get the ball, he just fell to the ground. And when that happens, Brendan, when you see a tackle in a football match, you go, oh, that was a tough one, or oh, he didn't touch him. Well, when a player falls like that without being touched, you know really that there's only one or two things that could have gone wrong. And you saw his teammates, Thomas Delaney, the number 8 for Denmark, Simon Kjær, the number 4. These are among the hardest men I've ever seen on a football pitch. They're really, really tough guys, and to see how worried they were so quickly, and to see them running over. Now, I looked down.
How quickly did it dawn on Philip? How quickly was it dawning on people who, in the stands?
It took seconds for people in the stands to realise what the players realised very, very quickly.
Yeah.
As I say, I've been watching these things a long time, so I kind of had an idea what was happening. So I was preparing a news flash, and then when I was looking over, all I saw, I couldn't see who it was, but all I saw was the hands on the chest. And then you think, this is not good. So at that stage then, it wasn't complete silence, Brendan. It was like this sort of murmur, like people didn't want to speak out loud, like they didn't want to put this into words about what it was they might be seeing. And after that then, it actually just got worse, because we had this situation where the Danish players sort of formed a ring around him with their backs to him. I think only Simon Kjær, the team captain, was facing him as the medics came on, as the stretcher came on. And then they took out those big white sheets. You know the ones that you see in Hollywood movies when somebody is killed and they pull the sheet over them and you think, oh, Jesus, what's this? So we were trying to go, as during the sitting up in the stands, you're trying to establish what's happening. So I had the photographers in front of me with their big long zoom lenses, and we're trying to see what they can see, how close we can get to it. And just as time went on there, and it took a long time, Brendan, I couldn't tell you how many minutes, because time stopped in the 42nd minute of the game, but it took a long time. And then one of the photographers who was working with me says, I got it, I can see his hand. And at that stage, they were just starting to roll him away. And Christian, there was a sort of a murmur or almost a cheer that went up through the crowd as they started to roll him off. Now, often, it doesn't matter how badly injured somebody is, the crowd will applaud anyway as they're being removed. So that to me didn't say anything. But then the photographer said, his hand is up. And then we realised that maybe he might just make it.
And obviously high emotion among the Danish fans there must have been.
Oh, it was absolutely incredible, because even when he was taken away, and even that cheer sort of caught in their throat very quickly, because only part of the ground, and it was actually in front of the Finnish fans that he was wheeled away. So we waited and we waited and we waited for word of what was happening. And the stadium announcer came on and said, we'll let you know as soon as we know. The game is suspended. And we waited, and it seemed like an eternity. And it got up to about 7:30 local time when they made an announcement, and they said that Christian was in hospital, that he was conscious and communicative. And Brendan, I have never heard a cheer like it in my life.
Yeah, wow.
A full Croke Park couldn't have had that emotion.
And listen, was there a situation, Philip, whereby it seemed to that physios got there straight away, but it seemed to take a while for the emergency medics to get there, and the Danish captain stepped in and kind of started handling the situation?
Well, this is the thing about Seamon Carr, the captain. He's a man of action. He doesn't hang around. He's the same thing on the football pitch as he is off the football pitch. And he realised what was happening, and he got to work straight away. And then, you know, the medics would have been, like, Christian was on what we call the left touchline as the Danes were playing. The medics were on the right with their big stretcher, and it was forward to carry it on. So it did actually take a few seconds to get there, and Seamon wasn't hanging around. So he was the one, I was told afterwards, that he was the one who started to compress Christian's chest. Okay. And then they got there. But it has to be said that, you know, you mentioned there in the headline, is that, you know, the miracle in Copenhagen. I would say this is the opposite of a miracle, because smart people did the right thing very, very quickly.
Yes.
And to anybody involved in sport, be it rugby or hurling or anything out there listening, like, learn CPR, because that's what saved that man at 29 years old with two children, one of them born in December last night.
Yeah, yeah. And again, all the cardiologists and everybody else you read today talk about how time is of the essence, like seconds of it, lost time, they call it, when that person is out. Every second they're out is compounding the damage potentially. Listen, there's a bit of soul searching going on, Philip. The BBC were tying themselves in conniptions again yesterday about the fact that this played out on camera for maybe too long after it happened, that people should have moved out to a wider shot quicker.
It's a very difficult one, Brenda, because they're not actually responsible. So they don't do this, the vision mixing themselves. They get that from a central feed from UEFA. And I know from friends in Norway and in Sweden that there was a lot of complaints about that as well. Now, I didn't see the TV pictures, but particularly close-ups of Christian, because, again, I've seen photographs that weren't published of Christian with his eyes open but lying lifeless on the ground. And that's a difficult one, because, you know, how much of that do you publish? How do you make those decisions? I mean, in hindsight also, it's very easy to say. But again, you know, an editor sitting maybe in RTE or in the BBC doesn't actually realise what it is that they're seeing at this point in time. Like, I was sitting there, and I'm not going to lie to you, Brendan, my fingers were shaking trying to type this, you know, trying to type what was happening there, because I knew what was happening. And I can only imagine what it was like for somebody maybe in RTE or BBC or in NRK in Norway trying to make those split-second decisions, you know. So it's very easy to criticise after the fact. And, you know, I wouldn't be a one, you know, again, we were out in the team hotel this morning, and the Danish Football Association said we prefer people weren't here, and we respected that, and we walked away from that, and we're not going to publish anything that we did out there this morning. So, okay, you know, there is sort of lines to be drawn, but in the heat of the moment, it's very, very difficult to make those calls.
And Philip, I think the other thing that people are concerned or surprised about is the fact that these guys are tested regularly and tested a lot, aren't they? So it's kind of, it's a bit scary to think that something like this could happen, or it's a bit inexplicable.
Yeah, it is. I mean, the thing is, thankfully, it's something that's very, very rare, but it's not entirely unknown, Brendan. So Mark Vivian Foye, a Cameroonian player, would have died during the African Nations Championship in a very similar situation. I think it was back in 2003.
Yeah. Fabrice Muamba, another player playing
for Bolton Wanderers. So, you know, it does actually happen, and it happens in amateur sport, it happens in professional sport. And some of these things, now, we don't know. Nobody has come out and said, this is what happened to Christian Eriksen. So we don't know, so we can't say. But some of these things are there. I mean, there was a basketball player this year, Marcus Aldridge, who was traded to a team, and all of a sudden he retired because in the medical process, the medical testing process, they discovered a similar fault with him, or they discovered a heart problem with him. So these things can remain hidden for many years, and then they just show up.
Okay.
I mean, I remember seeing Christian Eriksen in 2011, you know, brilliant on that pitch, and you never would have thought that this might be how his career would end. I sincerely hope that's not the last we've seen of him on a football pitch here in Copenhagen.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, Philip O'Connor in Copenhagen, thank you very much. Ingrid, were you watching the match?
I wasn't actually watching it, but I did follow it on Twitter, follow the reaction on Twitter. And yeah, I'd like to join in praising the swift action of the people on the pitch, and also the respect that the team showed to their colleague by forming that shield around him to give him privacy. Because, yeah, I mean, I'm sure they were contemplating what was happening. You know, his wife would have been watching that match, and it must have been such a difficult situation. But there seems to have been huge respect shown. And
yeah,
I think
and
I
listen, it's funny, isn't it, that, like, that was people acting on instinct, and their instincts were so noble, weren't they?
No,
you know,
absolutely.
Because they didn't have time to think about what's the right thing to do. They automatically did the right thing.
I know, but I think that, you know, generally, even when you're at the peak of competitive sport, you see that there is always decency, and where there isn't that decency, we tend to rebel against it. The night before, I had watched 4 hours of tennis with Djokovic and Nadal,
yeah,
in an absolutely stunning match of titans, and yet you could see the mutual respect respect that was there of the players, even though somebody has to win and somebody has to lose. And it seemed that the other team yesterday were clapping the Danish team, but when they came back onto the pitch eventually in such difficult circumstances. So I think it's good to see that despite the difficulties, that there was respect in such a situation.
Paul, it's been very, I'd say it's been very good for football and for people's image of football. I mean, it's a terrible tragedy and everything, but we did see the best of sport there, didn't
we? Absolutely. And I think we also started a conversation around access to defibrillators and to life-saving equipment. I know I play American football, and immediately after, in the kind of hour after, we were kind of making lists of who's trained, who can use it, where is the defibrillator when we're at training. We know we've got an ambulance at every game, so we've got a medical team there, but if something does happen at training, God forbid, where is the equipment? Who's trained to use it is the crucial thing, isn't it? And you start that conversation because you look at it and Christian Eriksen's 5 years younger than me, you know, immeasurably fitter than me in any kind of reasonable sense. And these things can just happen, you know.
Were you watching the match?
Yeah, very surreal. I walked back in just as he'd gone down, and you kind of, you know, you think you're conditioned to think it's probably a clash of heads. It seemed like somebody was stabilising his neck, so he thought, oh, Jesus, he probably got a decent wallop. And then you kind of saw the hands going for the chest compressions, and you realised this is actually a lot more serious than we thought originally. And thankfully, you know, when they were walking him off, his teammates seemed relatively calm. So you're kind of going, okay, it's probably not the worst case scenario. So you're kind of almost reassured by that. But even then, just watching the restart of the game also was very surreal. You could tell the Danish players, unbelievable strength to even walk back out there. But, you know, the game was
people questioning whether that game should have gone ahead.
Personally, I thought that, you know, they said that they asked the players. I don't think you ask the players in that situation, because they're obviously going to say yes. They gave them the option of playing it today at 12. If I was in those players' positions, I'd probably just want, if there were my two options, I'd have just gotten it over and done with last night. Because can you imagine trying to go to sleep last night, knowing what had happened, trying to process that, but also knowing that you had to play the second half of an elite sporting event at 12 o'clock today. I mean, I think that's a really unfair position to have put those players in. And then, you know, you have the commentary, you know, you're expected to shift gears. You know, we're questioning, did a 29-year-old man almost die here? And then it's, oh, well, how will the Danes react? You know, how will their defensive line set up? You know, can they keep the passing going? And it's a very odd shift to make. And then you're talking about the quality of the game, and you're saying, well, the Danish players have gone through
an immeasurable trauma there.
And we're expecting them to be top-level footballers 2 hours later. I don't think that was fair on them at all.
Yeah. Cliona, were you watching it?
No, I'm not a footballer, but it came up on Twitter, and I was really shocked. You know, any sudden event in a healthy person. I know we're going to be talking about COVID later, but that's just like COVID itself. It often hits the strongest people in a most surprising way. I'm not at all thinking that this guy had COVID. This is clearly something else. So sudden, what do they call it? I'm not a clinician. Sudden adult.
Sad, isn't it?
But to come back to this point about people having to deal with something like this and progress, you know, with something really awful. It's something that we should be talking about. We're talking about trying to build resilience in us all and in our young people. And I'm not saying at all that it was a wrong decision, but I think
Christian Eriksen, did he not talk to them and say he wanted them to play the match?
I understand that, but there is a kind of a warrior mentality in elite sports, particularly men's elite sports, that, you know, you put your shoulder to the wheel and you get on with it. And I'm not sure that we really built in. I watched it on the telly from thousands of miles away.
And you wouldn't have been able to play a match after.
I was barely able to empty the washing machine.
Really?
You know, I was like, I kind of sat and watched the second half in a bit of a daze, kind of, because you're just not programmed to see something like that. And then you're expecting these guys to just put it to the back of their heads, and, you know, the spot where their friend was lying is now where their right back is trying to clear the ball. And you know, it's a tough position to be put in.
Okay, well, look, in a funny way, I think people almost having that to focus on in a way, was something that did bring people together in a different conversation. But our own problems, Cliona, and our own conversations go on and on. Now, there's a thread developing here, I think, impacted by a thread of conversation, impacted by what happened with Stobart Air, which we'll come to yesterday, but also from the events during the week. And I know Tony Holohan is in front of the finance or the transport committee on Wednesday to talk about the science behind antigen testing. You're in the Mail on Sunday today, kind of making the case for antigen testing. Can we talk first about the gigs during the week? A lot of people, I thought that the politicians, I won't name who they were on trying to defend there not being antigen testing at it. And they didn't actually believe what they were saying. They were tying themselves in knots.
It was very odd. It was really very odd. I mean, it was just such a missed opportunity. Of course, there are problems with the antigen tests. You know, no test is perfect. The PCR test isn't perfect either. There's a very small number of false positives and false negatives with the PCR test. With the antigen test, then there's a huge range of antigen tests. And you're seeing in the papers, there are some being sold and being used that might not necessarily be the best possible. So our country should be deciding what would be the good ones. Yeah. And they were used so successfully in the meat factories. It just seems so bizarre that we weren't using
and
them.
And the HSE are using them in hospitals.
That's what I understand.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And tell me, in terms of the problems with them, the people who argue for them say that you would catch people who are infectious largely with them. We hear, oh, they're only 50% accurate, but that you would catch maybe the right 50%. Is that correct?
Well, again, there's huge variation. And there are, and this is also what we need to be careful of. There are some really fly-by-night ones that have been produced that have very low sensitivity. Okay. And so that is a big issue, is trying to. But nevertheless, the ones, there are several on the market that have between 70 and 80% sensitivity. That means ability to be able to pick up the infection if it's there. And so at that gig at Ivy Gardens, there must have been, judging from the infection rate, there must have been several people who were infected. Now, the way it was held, they shouldn't have been, because it was outside and because there were distance, nobody should have picked it up from anyone else.
No, you felt we could have had that concert 6 months ago, like the way
exactly.
It was set up.
But we would have, at least it would have told us how many in the 500 would be, approximately. Yeah. Now, what everybody, and I completely appreciate this, what the public health doctors are worried about is that those who test negative are false negative, but actually are infectious, that they'll go around thinking that they're not infectious. Yeah. And will say to everybody, I'm not infectious, and go into crowded places, and therefore be a risk to others. But I think the population is really well informed now, and we can explain that to people. The antigen test is very different to the diagnostic test. Diagnostic, the PCR is for diagnosing, for picking up the definite infection. The antigen test is just to see how many people out there have the virus.
Ingrid, you have that kind of Ingrid Miley look on your face.
Would you mind explaining what an Ingrid Miley look is?
It's a look that down the years a lot of people would have got slightly nervous when they saw, but a look saying that this is nonsense. Been dealing with a lot, I guess you've been talking to up to recently in your work, a lot of workplace situations and everything else. Is it madness that we're not using antigen tests more, do you think?
Well, the first thing is, I'm not an expert.
Obviously.
I haven't a clue. I defer to Cliona on this and to Neffet and everybody. But the only thing I would say is, we're in a situation at the moment of flux. On the one hand, we're progressing a vaccination program. So theoretically, the pool of infectious or infectable people should be shrinking, okay? Secondly, we've still got the traditional restrictions and measures. If you feel you've got a sniffle, go to get the PCR test. If you want to go somewhere, get the PCR test. I mean, people who have to have contact with people with cancer, for example, are having a PCR test before they see them. I know that from somebody I know. You know, so I can't see how bringing in a belt and braces additional tool is a problem. And as I said, as long as people are told this is not a blank check, this is not, that you are, completely ad infinitum clear. Now, theoretically, and I know that there are all sorts of rare chances, once you're double vaccinated and you've had the runoff period, theoretically you are close to being able to live that life. The person who isn't in that situation and who, you know, like the antigen thing, greater minds than mine seem to be suggesting, yes, like Cliona, that it is a belt and braces thing that could add to our pickup.
And that
pickup
is complementary to everything.
Complementary,
else. Yeah.
That's
yeah.
the point. I don't think it's a substitute.
That's exactly
make another,
that's,
you
that's
make
the
another,
mistake
yeah,
that is being
yeah.
made in the way that this is being portrayed. It's being portrayed as a substitute for everything to do with symptomatic and all of that. And I think that, you know, I think there needs to be more exploration, not just in relation to events, but also particularly in relation to aviation. And I know you want yeah, to talk about yeah. that in a while, but I think that is...
Okay, we'll come to aviation in just 1 minute. Mm. You brought up an interesting thing there, though, Ingrid, which is that people who are vaccinated technically should be able to kind of... Because if you can't get back to normal, Cliona, after you're vaccinated or some kind of normal or start living your... Then we have no hope, do we?
Well,
but yet,
true.
People who are fully vaccinated, they have these minor vaccine bonuses, but they can't really go anywhere or do anything that the rest of us can't do.
Exactly. And so maybe later we can develop the discussion onto the vaccine passports. Are they
well,
the
let's,
travel
well,
certificates?
Sure, look, it's here now.
Here.
Let's talk about it.
Yeah.
What's your thought?
Absolutely. We need to be discussing it. It's going to be so important to be able to determine how many people are vaccinated and to decide then how we're going to behave around that. I agree completely with Ingrid about the travel and the aviation industry. And you know, I'm a university professor. I want to see all the students back in the on campus in September, all the children back at schools. How are we going to be able to do that if we don't know whether the staff are protected or the people are protected?
That's and you think so antigen tests, and Simon Harris is trialling antigen testing,
antigen
isn't he,
testing,
for third level.
And I think we will, I feel sure that there, it's only a short amount of time until we all carry a vaccine passport
yeah.
to say whether, because a point we need to make is that even though these vaccines are wonderful, they're not 100%. So there's going to be 10%, 1 in 10 people who aren't protected by the vaccine, either because they don't make an immune response or because they can't take the vaccine for whatever reason. So to get herd immunity, we need to know that 80% or 90%. Now, we've got a very high, Ireland is in a wonderful situation where we've got great acceptance for vaccine. There is some vaccine hesitancy, of course, which again is completely understandable, and we can talk about that a little bit more. But nevertheless, the uptake of the vaccine is being
yeah,
celebrated.
We're world beaters, aren't we?
Yeah.
We love when we're leading the world in things. Ingrid, you wanted to come back in?
No,
there.
I was just saying that it's really important that on the antigen testing, yes, it's not perfect, but I mean, wasn't it Mike Ryan who said, don't let the perfect yeah. be the enemy of
exactly.
the good?
Exactly.
And if you have something, like if it even
exactly.
picks up one or two or three or four, and they then contain themselves,
that's it.
You've reduced
yeah.
some
it's
element of
one.
Spread. You won't reduce
yeah.
it all. Nothing, as Cliona just said,
yeah.
nothing's going to reduce it all. But, like, again...
I've seen, actually, Malcolm Gladwell, I know, look, you can agree or disagree with him, but he made a very similar point, and he looked into it. And his thing is, you know, there are strong link problems and weak link problems, right?
Yes.
So that a basketball team is a strong link thing. If you have three good basketball players, it doesn't matter who the rest
right.
of the team are, right? This is a classic weak link problem where you're only as good as your weakest link, right? And he's saying this is why antigen testing, we should be using it all the time. Any weak link you can
exactly.
take out of the chain.
Helps.
He says this would probably be over if we'd gone with antigen testing from the beginning. Paul,
but on the other hand, Brendan, were the antigen tests at the beginning as good or as bad as they are?
Well,
and I think the important
yeah.
thing that Cliona was saying is,
yeah.
like, if you're going to have antigen testing, streamline it, own it, get
exactly.
the good tests, weed out the bad ones,
exactly.
you know,
yeah.
like take control of it rather than allowing people to be buying them wherever.
Well, no,
and
we don't know. I think the ones that you can get in the supermarket, we don't know that they're not great. Apparently they test very well.
Sorry, I wasn't saying
yes,
that any
yes.
particular one was in any way questionable. I'm saying that on the basis
yeah.
of medical commentary.
Absolutely, that we should be officially identifying them.
That's
yeah. Paul, the politics of this, people are starting to talk again about the government being held hostage by NPHET and everything. It does seem that most politicians, when they're caught on their own, and when it's not linked to a gig or something, they'll say, yes, we should be doing far more antigen testing. The Ferguson report and everything. What's going on there politically, do you think?
Well, I suppose the one of the major things is that this feeds into a narrative that throughout this pandemic that the government and that Irish society at large has just had no room for flexible or innovative responses. So I think with regards to the antigen testing, my sister just got back from the UK where she was for a medical procedure. Her husband was with her. He got given an unlimited number of antigen tests by the hospital and was allowed book in for an hour a day. So he takes the antigen test himself, brings it down to the hospital, shows them that it's negative. He can go up to the ward for an hour and then go home. There's nothing similar in the Irish mindset throughout this entire pandemic in any way, shape or form, particularly with regards to antigen testing. And I think a lot of it from politics comes back to December. The last time that the government deviated from NPHET advice in any real measure was December, and we saw what happened in January. Since then, there's been a real, not reluctance, but almost a real reticence to walk away from anything.
Yeah, like Leo Varadkar is certainly not going to come out against NPHET again, is he? He got badly burnt that
Not
time.
In the way he did in October. Yeah. And you, to a certain extent, you understand that. But at the same time, you know, the chief science officer and the Minister for Health, I was at the event in the Department of Health where they launched this report on antigen testing, and they talked about all of the ways it could be used. They talked about pilot programmes that could be used in education and higher education. They talked about how it could be trialled in mass events. And here we are, we're in the middle of June. None of it's been used. We're still arguing about whether or not we should be using them. A member of NPHET is fighting Lidl on Twitter about them. You know, it just feels like we've kind of got stuck into the same three narratives every couple of weeks with this pandemic, and we're not advancing it at all. You know, I have a couple of antigen tests at home. Me and my wife are going away tomorrow for a couple of days. We're going to take them tonight just for an extra peace of mind.
Yeah.
I think to come back to...
Will you feel then, okay, I'm good to go?
No, we won't feel bulletproof, but we'll have that peace of mind that, you know, we're not infectious, or that we have that extra, you know, we don't have any symptoms. We haven't been around a whole lot of people the last couple of weeks. And then you take the test as a bolster. I think the people who will take a test, get a negative result and act like they're bulletproof probably would act like they're bulletproof without the test.
Exactly. Yeah.
So you're going to catch some people, and that's like Ingrid said, that's better than, it's not as good as being perfect, but it's better than being nothing.
No, Ingrid, the antigen conversation this weekend, a lot of it has been coming from the likes of IALPA, the airline pilots, and I think Forza to an extent as well, and certainly from people in aviation. So can you tell us first, what's the meaning and the context, you think, of this collapse of Stobart?
Well, I think it has come as a huge, a horrific shock to the staff. And I just, before I go anywhere, I'd just like to say, I feel so sorry for them. This is really rotten. But am I surprised? No, because this is part of a trend. I was just making a few notes before I came out. We've got the collapse of Stobart, 480 jobs. We've got a story in the Sunday Business Post, 500 plus jobs at risk in Lufthansa Technik, which is an aircraft maintenance thing. CityJet went into examinership last summer. It has come out much smaller, and the Irish operation almost eliminated. We've got the regional airports, Shannon, so many closures and what have you. We've got loads of people being laid off in Cork from September to November because of the new runway. We've got the Dublin Airport Authority, 1,000 redundancies, and they're still losing 700,000 a day after the restructuring that they've just done. So if you put all of that together, and that's before I mention Aer Lingus, they are in crisis. And I don't know, and I'm sure Paul is the same, I don't know how many Oireachtas committees I have sat through in the last 18 months where we have had people nearly crying. And by that, I mean, like, I hope he won't take exception. Eddie Wilson of Ryanair, the chief executive of Aer Lingus. We've had Paul Hackett of the travel agents. We've had the unions. We've had the people from the regional airports. We've had the DAA, everybody, all saying we need a plan. There was a report published last November, I think it was, Paul. They're still waiting for recommendations. The Green Cert, Travel Cert, is due to go live on the 19th of July. We still don't know at what point, as far as I know, Ireland joins into that. And in the meantime, you've got...
Well, I think it goes live in Europe on the 1st of July.
Oh, is that it?
And that we are going to join on the 19th. But again, I don't know how much certainty there is around that at this point. Yeah, so go on anyway.
But I mean, if you look at that, I mean, that is... That is frightening. And I mean, there's a very good story on the Sunday Times front page, and they cover this, and they say they show how the fall from grace has happened with Stobart Air. Its revenues fell by 73% in 2020, leading to losses of 36.8 million compared with profits of 5.5 million in 2019. That is the reversal that has happened. And there was an attempt made to buy it, that they couldn't get the finance and what have you. There's also now an issue as to whether the replacement airline that was due to take on the contract in 2023 will be able to finance itself and what have you. And you've got the connectivity loss for all of these regional airports, and not to mention passengers stranded, you know. It is huge.
Okay. Now, Pat Byrne, CEO of CityJet, is actually on the line. Pat, good morning.
Morning, Brendan.
Pat, would you agree with Ingrid there that, like, while this is a shock, it's no surprise to you or to your colleagues in aviation?
No, it's not a surprise at all. It is, and I would concur with Ingrid. I mean, it's appalling for the people who work in Stobart, and you know, my heart goes out to them. And I think everybody in aviation would feel the same this morning. But it is, we've been in this, this has been coming for quite a while, not just saying it's Stobart, but the industry has been under severe threat. And it's quite clear to me anyway that government has, for whatever reason, decided that the near destruction of the Irish aviation sector is acceptable collateral damage in their response strategy to COVID.
Okay, look, let's have to rehearse this argument with you, but Pat, like, we're dealing with a major public health situation where we know that travel is a big part of this. We know that travel twice last summer brought a load of COVID back here from Spain, and we know that at Christmas it brought the UK variant in here. So did the government have any choice but to shut down aviation?
Of course, it had a choice. It always had a choice. And as to the discussion you were having a few minutes ago there, you were talking about the absence of a new tool in the box in the fight against COVID, and that new tool, of course, being antigen, and also a proper approach to screening and testing. And if you go back to what you're saying about, you know, importing from other countries, whatever, last summer we didn't have any proper regime of screening whatsoever for people movement in and out of the country. It is possible to do proper screening, and it is possible to deploy antigen testing, particularly and immediately before flights, even on a random selection basis, using the principle of sampling theory that's very successful in lots of processes and industries and so on. So I do not think that any serious effort or attempt was made to listen and to employ a proper regime of screening and testing that could have facilitated a lot more movement safely.
Okay. Now, Pat, what needs to happen now? So in terms of, are you heartened by the fact that we have the European Green Cert is coming online, that we will apparently be able to travel within Europe from here, all things remaining equal with Delta and everything, from the middle of July? Is that all good news?
It's good news if you're living in the rest of Europe. It's not good news if you're living in Ireland. Most of our business now is in Scandinavia, and we're very much in touch with what the different countries over there are actually doing. And we actually can see the lifting of restrictions. We can see proper regimes going in place, and we can see a return towards better traffic figures. In Ireland, unfortunately, I think that NPHET are going to continue to obstruct and obfuscate. It's quite clear that the CMO does not want travel. It's quite clear that a number of government ministers are giving out confusing and conflicting messages.
Well, he does not want travel, I guess, if he doesn't think that travel is safe. And that if if you look in the UK, Pat, like, they're getting themselves into a bad situation again there. And that's with being really careful about travel and everything. But this thing, it seems you give it an inch, it can take off like a rocket.
There will be the variant after the variant, and there'll be another one again. We could be at this for the next 5 years. The fact is, we have protected the vulnerable, which is what the Great Barrington Declaration said well over a year ago. Protect the vulnerable. The vulnerable are now protected. They're mostly vaccinated. They're certainly very heavily vaccinated in the UK. And we have done that job. You cannot stop the spread of a virus like this. It's not possible to stop it.
Okay.
You can protect the vulnerable from it, and you have to get on with living. There's no such thing as life without risk.
What do you want to see happen now, Pat?
I want to see a proper opening of the common travel area between Ireland and the UK with a clever and smart deployment of antigen testing to make that as safe as we possibly can. And I want to see this, and I want to see the cessation of this obfuscation on the green certificate. And I want to see Tony Houlihan stop saying that he will not accept antigen testing when every other country is accepting antigen testing as part of the green certificate. I want to see the green certificate rolled out, and I don't want to hear of pathetic excuses that we couldn't get the tech organised by the 19th of July.
Well, I think the tech is organised, and I'm pretty sure I heard Oisin Smith say that a million people will straight away be able to, the million people who've been vaccinated will straight away be able to get download their cert, and they'll be good to go.
Yeah, but is that medical apartheid, only the people who are vaccinated? The green certificate is more than just vaccination.
Yeah, but I presume the others will be able as well. I think he was just taking that as an example of that the tech is ready to go. So, look.
Well, I sincerely hope that it is. I actually have my doubts. I have not a lot of confidence in that.
Okay. All right. Pat Byrne, CEO of CityJet. Thank you very much. Cliona, your thoughts on that there. Is Pat right? Antigen testing, let's start travelling again?
Oh, absolutely.
Really?
Yeah. Of course we have.
I thought you'd be quite cautious as an immunologist.
I am cautious, but it's exactly like Pat says this, and you said yourself in your article this morning that that we need to think about what the future is going to hold. We don't go back to nothing. You don't ever go back. We have to go forward. This virus is all over the planet. I'd like to come on to that in a little while as to what we should be doing about that. But so in the meantime, we really need to be developing plans of how to live.
Living
more
with COVID.
Yes.
Yeah. That phrase again is kind of gone into disrepute, isn't it? But maybe we should start thinking that way again. Yeah. So living with COVID. So travel, for example, would you be happy with people traveling? Would you be happy with the common travel area, for example, right now?
Well, if I knew, this is part of the whole discussion. Not right now or right at the moment, because we don't have the antigen testing in.
Okay.
We don't have the travel certificate. So we need to make sure that those are all put properly
okay.
in place.
So with antigen testing and with the travel certificate.
Yes. Then
okay. So on the specific.
And can I just finish? Yeah. Sorry, one point. We should be carrying out research on that then. All this data is new. People think that research is what's carried out in a lab with expensive equipment.
Yeah.
But this is all the time generating new data. And I feel Paul's point was absolutely right about us not being really agile enough and flexible enough for such a smart little country that we're not constantly asking these research questions, coming back with data and making decisions based on the data.
Yeah, so on a specific one there that had bothered people in the last week or so was this notion that, say a lot of people who are vaccinated can travel, that they would have to buy PCR tests for their children at either end. Would you say that an antigen test would be good enough in that situation for people who want to travel this summer?
If they were vaccinated?
No, for the children.
For the children? That's a tough one.
Yeah,
that is a tough
so
one
you,
to know of the
you
data.
Think possibly a PCR is.
Yes, and I understand the expense of it, but you would have to have if you want to be absolutely sure. And this again is where society has to decide where it's going to place itself. I mean, we have been living in a very, very conservative way of thinking towards the whole thing, and this is what exactly the point Paul is making.
Yeah,
are there other ways of looking at these problems?
I saw the CMO being asked. I don't know, was it by you actually, Paul, or one of your colleagues? Being asked a few weeks ago in talking about the events and saying there was an event in a nightclub in Liverpool, you know, which was very widely carried around the place. Like when the UK are being this inventive, they did that event in the nightclub. They tested everybody before and afterwards and everything else. And he said, sorry, I'm not aware of that. A nightclub in Liverpool? And I thought,
Well, the Barcelona test event where they held a music concert, that was on the weekend before Ireland launched its antigen test report, which had taken, you know, 3 or 4 months to get to the point of publication. And that there was issues there because some of the members of the panel which put the report together didn't agree with the overall findings. But when you see where other people are in terms of things like antigen testing or like answers for the long term, you do get frustrated, and it feeds into that narrative that we're behind. You know, we're at this point now where it's the 14th or the 13th of June today. We're talking about the Passport going live on the 19th of July. That's a month away. Travel agents need to get bookings. Airlines need to take bookings. People need to know, am I booking 2 weeks off work so that I can go on holiday from the 20th of July? Am I allowed to do that? Is it something that I can do? Am I fully vaccinated if I feel comfortable doing those things?
Yeah.
And we don't have an answer. We don't have a government response that says, here's what July will look like in regards to travel.
Okay, Ingrid.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's one thing that's very important, though. Look what's happening in the UK. You alluded to it yourself, yeah. Brendan. Boris Johnson has been ahead of the world in vaccination, or very, very close to it. It has been his Boris bounce, if you like. Yeah. He is now looking at delaying the reopening.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because of this Delta variant. Yeah. This is not something that's being imagined. For him to risk taking the political hit of delaying that reopening, it has to be serious. That's and true. I think
and
in
we
fairness,
are very exposed to the Delta variant here. We just are, like.
I don't know if you heard Michael O'Leary yesterday afternoon on Katie Hannan, and he said, I can't understand this. It's like he didn't quite say King Canute. We're putting up all these barriers at two airports. And yet people can seep across with the Delta variant at the border. Can somebody please explain the logic of that to me?
Yeah.
So, you know, I do think that this Delta variant has altered the balance a little. We need a little bit more information on that. So, you know, I don't want to sound like it's a witch hunt on public health doctors who have absolutely bona fide concerns about everything. And as I said, the UK experience is quite worrying.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, let's reflect here the fact that they're operating within a pandemic. We have done reasonably well in it with our cautious approach. We're in a better position than a lot of places in the world. And there is danger still out there. Absolutely.
I do think
okay,
though,
quickly, Paul.
It comes down to speed. We talked about it again. On the front page of the Sunday Independent today, we have cabinet sources telling Jodie Corcoran that we're in a race against time. Paul Murphy made that exact same line in the Dáil 4 weeks ago about the same variant, about the vaccine rollout.
Yeah, and I think that in fairness, they're getting the vaccines out there as fast as they can.
Oh, they absolutely are, but we have to move quicker.
Yeah. Well, with the vaccines as we get them. Yeah, let's take a break.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Our panel are still with us, Ingrid Miley, Paul Hosford and Cliona O'Farrelly. Paul, the Sunday Times has a poll today that's getting a lot of attention. Can you talk us through that?
Yeah, well, I suppose the major point of attention is this huge swing towards Sinn Féin and away from Fine Gael, almost like for like swapping of percentage points. So Sinn Féin tops the poll on 34% of support. Fine Gael, that's up 4. Fine Gael is on 24, down 4. Fianna Fáil on 20, down 2. Greens on 4, down 1. Social Democrats, a decent bounce for them. They're up to 4, up 2. Labour down 1 to 3. And then Solidarity, People for Profit and Ain't 2 on 1 each. And then Independents and Others on 9. Now, obviously, margin of error is 3.3%. It's still a massive 10-point lead for Sinn Féin. If you account for the margin of error, if everything was equal, they'd still be ahead by, you know, 2.5, 3 percentage points, which is absolutely huge. And I suppose it talks about what this means for Dublin Bay South. The by-election, we're expecting it sometime in mid-July or maybe late July at this point. You know, whether or not this is an actual bellwether, whether or not Sinn Féin has moved the needle enough to win that seat. We don't want to fall into the trap of assuming that it's a straight race between Sinn Féin and Fine Gael, but it's definitely looking early enough like that's going to be the narrative that takes over.
And the narrative was very much this is James Gagan's to lose, but is there a sense that Ivana Bacic in there and Sinn Féin in this poll, there's a sense that there could be more of a fight here than Fine Gael might have thought?
Yeah, and I suppose the Fine Gael had the first mover advantage, so they had a councillor in place who had been groomed in a lot of ways to take over from Owen Murphy. I think a lot of people within Fine Gael probably expected that to happen further down the line. I think the timing of Owen Murphy's resignation was probably a little sooner than they'd hoped, but James Gagan is popular locally. He definitely hits the same notes that Owen Murphy would have hit in the constituency. And so when Owen Murphy resigned or retired, whatever way you want to characterise it, James Gagan was ready to move. And we kind of knew that the local constituency organisation was right behind him. The change there really since that has been the entry of Ivana Bacic and Lynn Boylan, two very, very high profile women, members of the Seanad, both excellent spokespeople on different parts of Irish society. And that's really made this a real race.
Okay, and there are other candidates as well, and we maybe should read out all their names, and you might get that into me. Ingrid, we'll come back to that in a sec. On the broader picture this weekend, the action is all centred around St Ives, and you picked out a piece that Shane Ross wrote in the Sunday Independent, "Peacemaker Needed for Protocol."
Yeah, I think that... Like, I've been watching the G7 and I find it fascinating because we've got, on the one hand, this positive development that Joe Biden has come onto the world stage and tried to restore relations that had been, shall we say,
America's
politely
back.
Disrupted for quite some time. But he's walked into this one step removed from trade war between the UK and the EU. And slap bang in the middle of that trade war is us. Or Northern Ireland, the protocol, and or what's been almost laughingly, but not a laugh at all, being called the sausage wars about all of this. And Shane is making the point that there's a need for like a George Mitchell to come into this as a supra mediator to try and bring this in, because everybody is coming at this from their position the EU is saying, you signed up to this. It's a no-brainer. Look, read the words. Boris is saying, well, actually, you know, it's a matter of implementation. You're cheating, kind of thing.
Yeah. And Boris is also saying now that he's saying that apparently this was something Macron said to him, that Boris said something about bringing sausages from Toulouse to Paris. And Macron said, well, that's different because Toulouse and Paris are in the same country. And Boris went bananas. And this is apparently why he came out so strongly yesterday.
And
that
saying
these
that
foreign johnnies need to understand this is all one country.
But also saying that he would be prepared to trigger Article 16. Which is quite momentous. But the other point that Shane made, and this is what interested me, was that there's not one person at those talks in St Ives or whatever the name of the place was that actually lives in Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
Poots wasn't there. Michelle O'Neill wasn't there. Nobody from any of the parties was there. And yet they're like Alsace-Lorraine, which used to be called the bone of contention. It's like it's on the table at all the big stuff. And yet none of the people who are actually involved are there. And I actually thought that was quite an interesting point.
Were you watching Vincent Kearney's report from the British Irish Council the other day? You're probably able to take a bit of a holiday from the news these days.
That is my plan.
The atmosphere up there. So I thought it was extraordinary. You did think, why don't these people actually sit down and eyeball each other more often? So we had Leo Varadkar chortling over coffee with Edwin Poots. We had, Paul.
I was in the room when Arlene Foster started to sing Frank Sinatra.
Yeah,
it was, you know, everything felt a lot calmer. Everyone felt on the same page. Michael Gove and Micheál Martin were calling each other by first names. They were discussing the quality of the sausage at the sit-down breakfast that they'd had that morning. It does feel like if you can get these people in a room, things can happen. But then you have Boris Johnson going on the news saying that nobody ever raised any concerns about Northern Ireland and Brexit. There was never a warning that this would disrupt things. And, you know, nobody wants to relitigate the Brexit campaign. But when the Prime Minister of the UK is saying there was never any warnings about Northern Ireland, you wonder, have we got an honest broker here? Do we have somebody who's genuinely invested in solving the problems here?
It's getting him voted
exactly.
Home, this
it
kind
works
of stuff,
because he's
it?
Hit. Yeah. He's hitting Johnny EU. He's
Ingrid. I wonder though about that. Them all sitting down together last week in Fermanagh and everything. In what you've seen of negotiations down the years, I presume like that, the communicating through megaphones, Twitters, RTE, public statements and all that, I presume once people sit down around the table and they're eyeballing each other, does everyone get a little bit more reasonable in that situation?
Well, often what you'll have is what you might call proximity talks, where people are in different rooms and the mediator shuttles and they're never actually all in the same room. But the other thing it's really important to isolate, Brendan, is who's the decision maker in the room. Who has the power to call it?
Okay.
And often the people who are in the room maybe are like, often it often happens with government, you know, where you negotiate, where a union is up against a government department or something. Who's actually calling the shots? Are the people that the mediator is talking to in the room actually decision makers, or are they having to refer back? And if you look at, you know, this whole question of the protocol and how it's going to be handled and how it fits in with the Good Friday Agreement, who are the decision makers? Because that's who you have to get talking to each other.
Of course.
Because at the moment it's all proxy. I mean, when I read about Lord Frost with his Union Jack socks, and I thought, really, are we at that level?
Yeah, yeah.
I think it was Lord Frost.
Yeah, okay. And listen, on the broader picture of the G7, Cliona, they're obviously making noises now about vaccinating the world and everything. You picked out a piece today in, where was it?
Yes, it's the Sunday Business. I was just going to ask if I could slip it in.
Elaine Byrne in
the Sunday Business Post, exactly. And the headline is West playing dangerous game with its vaccine nationalism. And that's the point I was making right very, very early on.
Yeah.
If we focus exclusively on ourselves, we're making this the same mistake again of refusing to see what's happening worldwide. And so therefore we have to contribute to the worldwide debate as to how everybody is going to be vaccinated. She has a really shocking figure here that 300 million people died of smallpox in the 20th century, and yet that virus is gone from the planet. Now, it took 24 more years to get it gone from the developing countries to the rich ones. We really need to have a global approach to this issue.
Am I right? Is smallpox the only one we've ever actually eliminated?
It and a cow virus.
Really?
Right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
But it's possible. And so that's why we must have a concern. Because for as long as the virus is anywhere on the world, it's mutating and producing other variants. So this is why I say us being obsessed with the four or five that are around at the moment, which are dangerous. I completely agree with what Ingrid says. We can't take our eye off the ball, but there's going to be more.
Yeah, yeah.
Unfortunately.
So listen, where does that leave us then in terms of, like, we read on the front page of the Sunday Independent today that NIAC is going to, they're hoping NIAC will approve a vaccine for under 18s, I think 12 to 18,
is it?
Going to start vaccinating them now. Is it right that we are vaccinating healthy 12 to 18 year olds while there are healthcare workers and, and older people and
vulnerable
people?
This is the big ethical dilemma.
This is a real ethical dilemma.
But at the same time, we know that young people can act as a reservoir of the virus that will bring it back in again. There's another great article just actually by Luke O'Neill's one recommending that we mix and match our vaccines. So again, it's just like Paul is saying, we need to be all the time more flexible. I mean, it's difficult to have a very clear message and a very clear plan when, as Ingrid says, where the whole situation is changing. But at the same time, we do need to have a little bit of flexibility.
On that flexibility, can I ask you a question? Because a chemist is very exercised telling me in the last few days that he was offered 50 Johnson & Johnsons to give to people over 50. And he said he's not taking them. He told them, no, I've no use for these, because he said basically most people over 50 are either done or about to be done and they don't want Johnson & Johnson. Should he be allowed to give those Johnson & Johnson, would you think, in the real world, should he be allowed to give them as a second dose to people who've already got an AstraZeneca or something, rather than just sending them back?
I would have thought so. But yeah. I'm not a doctor and I'm not a public health person.
I know, yeah, but it would seem to make sense. Yeah, because he thought it made no sense whatsoever to be sent these and told find people who are over 50. And you know, he's been dying to get involved.
Yeah.
And this is what he got. Anyway.
Yeah.
Listen, thanks a million, everybody. Thank you, Cliona O'Farrelly. Thanks, Ingrid Miley. And thank you very much, Paul Hotsford. That's all we've time for in that first hour.